All right, hi everybody, and welcome to Lecture 58 in this Ancient History program of History at Our House for the elementary class. We're now going to move to a very sad story. And it has to do with the disintegration of ancient Greece. The ruining of the wonders that were just getting started in the Athenian Golden Age. The Athenian Golden Age is a very difficult period in a way to understand and to teach because it's not like most of the things that we have studied. It's not like, let's say, the rise of democracy, where we're seeing something that's pretty simple to understand, really, what a government is and how it works, what a monarchy is, what a democracy. Those things are pretty straightforward compared to, let's say, what is philosophy, right? Or compared to the topic of education. What are those things? And those things are more complicated. And so they are hard to communicate. I tried to do a little bit of a story for you guys yesterday to teach you what I think is the importance of the Athenian Golden Age in a different sort of way by showing you this painting of the School of Athens. The reason why I wanted to show this to you was because the meaning of this painting is the meaning of the Athenian Golden Age. In one nice image. And the meaning is as simple as this. It's exactly the theme of the painting by the artist. The theme of the painting is Athens taught the world the love of wisdom. Plato and Aristotle were the philosophers. And Athens taught the world the love of wisdom. Or maybe to put it, because love of wisdom, right, is philosophy. It's a little bit, maybe a simpler way to express the theme would be Athens taught the world to think. But of course, think about what? It's such a complicated idea to teach that there were so many things that the Athenians taught the world. But really, they only started to be well learned and people really started to live by them only in what we call the Renaissance. So it's hard to present something like the Athenian Golden Age because a bunch of things are being invented. But then, because what we're going to learn about today, they never really took off. They never really got a chance to change Greece. Sadly, Greece was this wonderful, wonderful place where the people were trying oh so hard to come up off the archaic plateau. They were the first. They were the only ones that ever did it. And that job is super hard. In a way, to this day, people are, in so many ways, we're still stuck on the archaic plateau. Oh, I see somebody's arrived and is testing their audio. Let's see if we can sort that out. Okay, well, maybe that's Opal. Too bad you're late, Opal. We could have tested your sound. Do you want to try speaking? We'll try you out later. Okay, so anyway, like I said, the Greeks were trying to do something new. They were trying to make a new kind of life for human beings that involves the love of wisdom, that involves things like the study of history, that involves beautiful art. And they were just getting started. And then we get to this war, which is the subject of our story today, the Peloponnesian War. So it's very sad because just as they were taking off, they had to be grounded. I guess if you want to use a metaphor, like an airplane that's about to soar into the sky, and all of a sudden the control tower says, stop, get back here. And the plane has to land again. And you can't go where you want to go. You've got this fabulous destination that you want to go to, and it's a whole new way of life, but you're grounded and you can't go there. And that's what the Peloponnesian War is. And it has to do with, well, a word, I guess, it's hard to communicate this sort of thing. What it is that human progress is made of. Human progress is made of these small contributions that individuals make. They create new things. And at the beginning, they're the only ones that know it. Let's take an example, Christopher Columbus. We have this man. He is convinced that it's possible to sail west to reach Asia. And how many people on the earth are convinced that that is possible at first? How many of them are them? How many Christopher Columbuses are there? Opal says one in the chat. One day Opal will be back. So, yes. So there's only one. It's an idea in one person's mind. How does the world get changed? That person has to go out and he has to fight the whole world and get them to accept his new idea. And boy, is Christopher Columbus's story a good example of that. About how this one person with this courage to see something new and do something new has to fight everybody else. And gradually he wins allies. And eventually somebody decides to support him. And then finally he has a chance to do it. And then when he succeeds, then everybody's excited. Oh, the King and Queen of Spain. Oh, the King of England. Oh, the King of France. Everybody wants to get on board. Now, before he succeeded, nobody wanted to help him. They're all laughing at him and joking and thinking how stupid he is. The truth is, though, that he's the one person in the world that's got some good idea, and everybody else are the ones that are, well, I won't use the mean word. But, you know, it's this is where the progress comes from, is this small seed in the mind of one person, and then he has to go and fight everybody else and finally get them to accept it. And, well, Athens was like that. It was this place where there were people coming up with new things and having to try to convince everybody else. But meanwhile, you know, life is going on. Meanwhile, all the normal things are happening. And unfortunately, the normal things back in ancient times were exactly the kind of stuff we have seen so far. Archaic life. The archaic facts of life were weighing everybody down. The archaic facts of life were, there's this big Persian Empire, and you got to do something about it. So you got to fight a war. And then Athens decides that the best way to fight that war is to make its own empire. And then Sparta decides, well, okay, we got Sparta and we got Athens. Here's another way of looking at those two kind of groups of city-states and their allies, right? And they can't get along. It's an archaic fact of life. They're not going to convince each other. They're not going to be able to discuss this like it's a problem of philosophy where they sit down and one side convinces the other by a really interesting argument. They just could not get along. And so we have these two sides, And we know that Athens has democracy and Sparta has communism, and they are just not two city-states that could get along. And so last time we saw at the Athens here in Orange wanted to help a neighboring city-state called Thebes to get democracy. And Sparta, of course, had control of Thebes and didn't want to do it. So before you know it, the war with Persia is hardly over. But again, we have a conflict, and Athens and Sparta are going to fight each other for the first time now. They were temporary allies, but now they're going to fight each other. And that scared them. And they decided, I think the other day I said it was a 15-year peace. I had a mistake in my notes. It sounds better at first. They had decided on a 30-year peace. So it wasn't 15, it was 30. Sorry for that. I had an error in my notes. They decided, hey, let's not fight. Let's have a 30-year peace. And Patrick was, at the end of the class, I think it was Monday, was kind of making a prediction. He said, I bet this won't last. I bet that even the 15 years won't last. Well, of course, if 15 years is not going to last too well, probably 30 won't last either, of course, which is a pretty good prediction. And so how did these two city-states end up fighting each other and ruining what was going to, what could have been so much more beautiful in terms of the Golden Age of Athens? It's sad. So in the 30 years peace, Athens and Sparta agreed by a treaty and they said, we will not attack each other or our allies for 30 years. Okay, that's a very specific thing. We will not attack each other or our allies for 30 years. That's Athens and Sparta making a deal. Well, so how did it break down? How did the treaty not work, and how did they get involved in a war anyway, despite this promise that for 30 years they would not do something like that? Well, if you look over here on the map, you will see on the purple part of the map, you will see, oh, I can't always zoom in the way I want. You'll see the city-state of Corinth. And Corinth was an ally of which country? Patrick?
Sparta.
Okay, it's in purple, so it's an ally of Sparta. All right. And then, what we can't see on this map, because it's slightly off of this map, but I'm going to switch over to another map. There was an ally of Athens. I don't know why this guys who made this map did not include it, because it belongs over here. Here, way over here in this corner, there's a place, if you can read it, hard to pronounce, Corcyra, an island, a really beautiful island. People go there to travel there today. It's a place called Corfu, very famous tourist island and stuff like that. But back then, anyway, the city-state over there was Corcyra, and it was part of the Athenian alliance. Now, Sparta and Athens made a deal not to attack each other. But what about Corinth and Corcyra? Did they make that deal? Or any of the allied city-states hadn't made that deal? And so Corinth and Corcyra were two rivals. All of these city-states were rivals. And Corinth decided to attack Corcyra. Now, the only reason to mention this is to learn one of the details of this war. We're going to learn very few of them. But how did the wonder of the Athenian Golden Age come to an end? How did it get derailed? It's very sad. It has to do, again, with the archaic facts of life. And it has to do with two city-states being rivals of each other, wanting to defeat the other, Corinth attacking Corcyra, and Athens defending Corcyra. Because when your ally is attacked, What do you have to do? How do alliances work? Even if you are not attacked, Sigourney?
Defend and help your ally.
That's right. That's the nature of an alliance. If your ally is attacked, you have to defend and help your ally. Okay, now, see if you can see there's a little puzzle here. Somewhat interesting. Okay, the treaty, the 30 years peace said, Athens and Sparta will not attack each other or their allies. Okay, now, Corinth is attacking Corcyra, and Athens is defending Corcyra. Has the treaty been broken? Patrick?
Yes.
How's it been broken?
Because the allies are fighting each other.
Okay, but the treaty says Athens and Sparta will not attack each other and their allies. Has that been broken?
Well, not the Sparta and Athens part, but the allies part has.
Okay, but pay attention. I know you're exactly working on this problem here, which is why it's a puzzle. You're saying the allies part has, but notice what the allies part is. It doesn't say Athens and its allies and Sparta and its allies will not attack each other, blah, blah, blah. It's only a deal between Athens and Sparta. It says Athens and Sparta will not attack. Is that what happened? Did Athens or Sparta attack? No. Right? What did Athens do? Athens defended an ally. Did it break the treaty? It's kind of hard to say, right? I mean, it acted, it went to war, but it didn't attack. Henry, Wyatt?
This is Henry.
Yeah.
They did not break the treaty.
Okay, because they didn't attack, right? They defended. All right, so technically you could say they didn't attack, but it was really Corinth's fault that all of this got started because of their attack on Corcyra. But then Corinth could do, you know, what archaic countries and city-states are a lot like little kids. Corinth could say, well, Corcyra did this. And Corcyra would say, well, Corinth did that. And that's kind of the way that archaic countries and city-states are. They're a lot like children. They have arguments and they can't resolve them and then they fight. And so that's what had happened. Corcyra and Corinth had been enemies and rivals for a long time and fighting this and that battle against each other. So Corinth could say, we've got plenty of reasons why we have a right to attack Corcyra. And then they could say, well, the thing that went wrong here was that Athens butted in on this. They had no business, getting in on this conflict. It has nothing to do with them. But Athens would say, well, no, we are allied, and you knew that when you attacked Corcyra, and so really it's your fault. Okay, but here I'm just kind of setting up an argument, right? And the whole point about when you have these archaic facts of life here is that nobody wins an argument like this. There's never a winner. It's just an argument. It's just two sides, two people who have decided that they're going to yell at each other and disagree no matter what. And eventually they're going to fight. And the Spartans weren't sure what to do. They went to the oracle at Delphi, and the oracle said that if they committed their entire might to the contest, that they would win. So the oracle, in a sense, told the Spartans that if there was a war, that Sparta would win. And so the Spartans decided to go ahead and fight this war. All of their allies were yelling and arguing with Athens and complaining to the Spartans. And finally, the Spartans decided, okay, let's see. What would our oracle tell us about a war? And the oracle told the Spartans that they were going to win. So we do get this terrible war called the Peloponnesian War. And it's one that people used to study in very, very great detail. And there's an important reason why. Because of the Athenian Golden Age. Because this was the time in history where history was born. This is the time where, for the first time anywhere in the world, there were really some historians explaining events that had happened. And one of those historians of Athens is called Thucydides. Not the easiest name. It doesn't roll off the tongue or anything. Patrick doesn't know, but he was almost called Thucydides. I decided to call him Patrick Henry Powell in honor of one of the founding fathers. And it's a nice sounding name. It's kind of alliterative. But he was almost called Thucydides Powell. But I think that would have been a hard one for him to explain to his 8-year-old play partners. So Thucydides was a general in the war, and he was also one of the first historians ever, and he wrote the story of what happened. Which is why, if you go on Amazon, you can find The Peloponnesian War by Thucydides. The History of the Peloponnesian War by Thucydides. And it is an incredibly detailed story of what happened. It is really, really detailed. And it used to be that people read this story in every detail. They read it because what they were so excited to do was to see one of the first historians ever and what he had to say. What it was like when history was born, when one of the first historians ever wrote a story, what did it look like? What did he think was important to record? What did he show about the Greeks? And what can we learn about ancient Greece? And so on. So it used to be, well, I'd say about 100 years ago, when people still really valued history, it was very common for students to read this story. And not kids your age, but more college-age students would always read this because it was an example of the birth of history and also, sadly, of the story of how the Athenian Golden Age came to an end. And so it's very famous. But as it turns out, it's not a story that we need to know any of the details of. It is especially complicated. And I have studied it quite a lot and made as much sense of it as I can. But the truth of it is that the Peloponnesian War is what I would call an archaic war. So in other words, it's not something that tells us anything about the Greeks. Sadly, you would think it's a war between the Greeks. But it's not a war that tells us anything important about the Greeks because it's a war. And what was important about the Greeks? Fighting wars? Anybody can do that. Every barbaric and primitive society and every advanced and modern one too, they all fight wars. There's nothing special about that. So, unfortunately, it is not a story that is really important for us to learn, even though it's been considered so important because it was one of the first histories ever written. That's fine for historians, but for us, we don't need to know the details. Because what it shows us about the Greeks, sadly, is the worst part of them. The part that's no different than the Persians, the part that's no different than the Egyptians, the part that's no different than any of the other archaic peoples, the part that comes out when you are at war. Would you imagine that that's the best part of you? Because what do you do when you are at war? You might be a philosopher, or you might be a scientist, or you might be a teacher. But then, you go to war, and what do? In raw, horrible terms, what do? What these two men on the cover of the drawing are doing. What do, Sigourney?
You kill other people.
Yeah, exactly. Or you are killed yourself, right? And it is horrible. You murder other people and they try to do the same to you. And so it's not something that we're going to focus on in terms of the Greeks. You know what it is. We've seen so many wars. We will see so many more wars throughout history as human beings fail to maintain their civilizations, and it falls apart, and it's all ruined, and they kill each other in many, many, in large, larger numbers all the time. And so, as far as Greece is concerned, there's nothing about this war that can teach us anything about the Greeks, other than the fact that there was Sparta on one side, these military communists, and there was Athens on the other side, the democracy, and they all tried to kill each other. All right, now you know the heart of it. That's it. It's just an archaic, raw fact. Now, it does matter, but not in detail. What matters is what happens when a historian and a scientist and a teacher and an artist and all those other wonderful people, what happens to them when they go to war? They get changed, right? That experience hurts them. It damages their society. And not surprisingly, if you have this better kind of a government with a democracy, and it goes to war, and then that whole society gets really greatly harmed. It's so traumatic. Everything, so many people are dying. There's just so many horrors. And, well, what happens to that democracy? That is an enormous amount of stress. And assuming there is a democracy, well, Americans have this experience because Americans have, in modern times, gone to war quite a number of times. And when you go to war and it hurts a great deal, you guys are still a little too young to have quite a sense of how this has been, but America's has gone through this sort of thing recently, where the United States went to war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and it hurts. It doesn't work like you want it to work. Things go badly, and you have a democracy. What do people do? If it's a democracy, what do people do to decide how to fix things? What do they always do in a democracy? Patrick?
The majority wins over the minority.
Okay, good. The majority wins over the minority. In other words, they vote. Okay? And so, for instance, in modern American history, it's a very interesting example. We have President Barack Obama. Americans chose him in large part because they were upset, as a democracy, of what things had happened, the different things that had happened in Afghanistan and Iraq and so-called war on terror. So they changed their minds and they went with another leader. And this has happened many times in American history, where a war goes badly and then people want change. And the same things happened in Greece. the war went badly. So people wanted change. But in Athens, we know, well, it hadn't been a democracy long. It was a tricky situation where on the one hand, you had the aristocrats, and on the other hand, you had the commoners. And the aristocrats in particular felt that this bad war was democracy's fault. It was democracy's fault because in democracy, leaders will go to the people and they will say, oh, let's go to war. Vote for me. We will teach those Spartans a lesson. And the people said, okay, let's do it. Yes, we vote. The majority decides to go to war. And then the war is terrible. Well, whose fault is that? I don't know, right? You have to dissect the war and look at all the little parts of it and who did what and so on. There's lots. But what happens in a war is nobody really cares about the truth. They always just blame each other. Oh, it's your fault. No, it's your fault. And Opal suggests the people who voted for the leader. And this is very much one of those unwinnable arguments. And typically, yes, the people blame the leaders. And in this case, since it's a democracy, well, they blame the people who chose those leaders. You're the ones who got us into this mess. Look what you did. You voted for this and now it's not working. And so the Athenian aristocrats blamed the democracy. They said, the reason why we're in this problem, you know, we aristocrats would never have made this mistake. Who knows if they would or not. But they blamed the democracy. And so in 411, as this war was underway, temporarily, they overthrew the democracy. So here we have the Peloponnesian War. It's from 431 to 404. 20 years into it, the aristocrats overthrew the democracy in the year 411. So that means that the democracy of Athens in its original form just lasted just a little bit less than 100 years. Right? When did it start? Anchor fact of all human history? When did Athenian democracy start? Patrick?
Circa 408 BC.
Oop, you got that one wrong. Couldn't be four. Try again. We have arrived in 411 after nearly 100 years.
Oh, yeah,
508. All right, good. Circa 508 BC, right? And we've arrived at 411, and it's falling apart because of the war. So it was just temporary. The aristocrats did not succeed in their takeover of Athens this time. However, Athens lost the war. So Sparta won. Sparta won the Peloponnesian War, which basically brought an end to the Golden Age. We can date the Golden Age a lot of different ways. But what was going to happen, of course, now that the democracy of Athens had lost the war, you can bet that everybody was yelling at everybody and blaming everybody else. And we're going to learn a story next week about what I consider to be the end of the Golden Age. Because there was a philosopher living during the Golden Age and living during this time named Socrates. And he got caught up in all of these archaic arguments. And people were really angry with the questions that he was asking and the challenges that he was making and who his friends were and so on. And a lot of different things they were upset about. And they did something to him as a democracy, which really ended the Golden Age. So I'll tell you about we could call that the aftermath, which means the things that happened right at the end, and because of this terrible archaic war, basically Athens became pretty much just like the other archaic places again. And what was special about Greece came to an end. Very sad. Okay, well, yeah, the story of Greece, I gotta tell you, I've already warned you from this point on, is not positive. It's the story of a culture that almost created the beauty of the modern age 1,500 years ago. But did not. It failed. It could not succeed. And was dragged back into the muck of the archaic plateau. All right. On that sad note, that's it for today, folks. Talk to you tomorrow.